This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the new presidential administration and why it's useful to take a look back and reflect on the roots of fascism.
Yeah, I think it's alarmist to say that we're living under fascism. Clearly we're not, but the grains of it are there. It could develop into that. And that's what we're going to do on the show today through reflection and past interviews.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, a little over a week ago, you attended in New York City the wake of Lynn Stewart, our friend and colleague who recently passed away. What was it like?
Well, the whole family was there. A lot of people came. It was because she was a public figure. The family felt that they should open it up to the public. There was a big portrait of Lynn on an easel wearing a jacket that was embroidered by Palestinian women, given to Lynn by her supporters in Boston. There was a prayer card that was handed out, but it wasn't your usual prayer card. There was a picture of Lynn as a little girl, and then the picture of Lynn with the embroidered jacket on the front, and then a poem by Bertolt Brecht on the back. Heidi, read the poem.
And I always thought, and I always thought, the very simplest words must be enough. When I say what things are like, everyone's heart must be torn to shreds. That you'll go down if you don't stand up for yourself. Surely you see that.
Thank you, Heidi.
And Michael, when is the memorial service going to be held?
I think it's April 28th or 29th, but I'll find out and we can announce it on the air.
Wonderful. Michael, I know that you've been reading a lot recently about Donald Trump and Roy Cohn, and not all of our listeners may know who he was.
Well, the best article that I've seen, and we can post a link to it on lawanddisorder.org, is by Sidney Blumenthal, which came out 3 weeks ago in the London Review of Books. I think it's helpful because we've all been talking about what do we have here with this obviously disturbed person, Trump, and the very far right-wing GOP that came in with him. Is it fascism? Is it pre-fascism? How do you label it? And if you can come to grips with what it is, then you can figure out what we can do about it. And that's what I've been reading about. And the paragraph in the Sidney Blumenthal article that struck me as being the most perceptive and what I'd like to share with you is this. What Trump represents above all is the triumph of an underworld of predators, hustlers, mobsters, clubhouse politicians, and tabloid sleaze that festered in a corner of New York City, a vindication of his mentor, the mafia lawyer Roy Cohn, a figure unknown to the vast majority of enthusiasts who jammed Trump's rallies and hailed him as the authentic voice of the people.
Now, what corner of New York are they talking about, Michael? Is this a geographic area?
I think, you know, Trump was one of those bridge and tunnel guys. He was raised in Queens. His father was a real estate developer also, a real crook and a racist. Was arrested in 1927, this is Fred Trump, at a Ku Klux Klan rally. He, with public money, because he was tight with New York City clubhouse politicians. With public money, he built housing for returning World War II vets and went out of his way to exclude black veterans from getting housing in the projects that he built. Woody Guthrie happened to be living in those projects and wrote a number of songs about Fred Trump. He hated Fred Trump. But Roy Cohn was the lawyer that Trump met when he took the bridge or tunnel over to New York City and started working with his father. So who's Roy Cohn? I think if you understand him and Trump's relationship to Cohn, you understand a lot about the current political situation.
Well, many of us know Roy Cohn because during Senator Joseph McCarthy's investigations through the House Un-American Activities Committee into communist activity in the U.S., Cohn was McCarthy's chief counsel and gained notoriety during those hearings.
Yeah, that's when he became nationally famous. But you know, Cohn was very, very, very smart. Went to Columbia Law School, graduated law school in 1947 after the war, and got a job because his father was quite influential. His father was a Supreme Court judge in the Bronx, and his father got him a job at age 20 as the assistant United States attorney in New York City. The first thing he did was he headed up the prosecution of 11 leading members of the Communist Party and put them in prison on conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government by force and violence. A conspiracy is the darling of the prosecutors as a charge because you don't have to prove an underlying crime or that it's a thought crime. You don't have to show that people did anything. And they framed up the Communist Party members, sent them to prison. His next victory was framing up and executing Julius and Ethel Rosenberg on the fake charge that they stole and gave to the Russians the secret of the atomic bomb. There was no secret to the atomic bomb. The United States had used the bomb in Hiroshima and again in Nagasaki, and the Russians, out of self-defense, developed their own bomb. And in American opinion, they couldn't believe that the Russians were smart enough to do this themselves, and somebody had to give them the secret. So they cooked up this fake story against Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, had them convicted. Roy Cohn conspired with the judge to make sure they got the death penalty, and they gave them the electric chair in Sing Sing. So that elevated Roy Cohn in the eyes of Joseph McCarthy, who hired him to be his chief counsel in Washington, and that's what Cohn did. When he left that job and moved back to New York City and bought a townhouse, made it into an office, Trump became one of his main clients.
It's interesting, Michael. In addition to Donald Trump, I just wanted to add that he also represented, well, in private practice, John Gotti, Studio 54 owner Steve Rubell and Ian Schrager, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York, and several others, including the New York Yankees Baseball Club.
Yeah. Cohn represented a lot of these right-wing figures, including the mafia. He helped out Donald Trump in his construction projects, made sure that he got the cement delivered right, made sure that there were no union problems. Trump became very close with Roy Cohn. He would call him once, twice, many times a day, every day. Cohn took him around. They palled around together, and they were close for many, many years. What was it that caused their split up towards the end? Well, Cohn was a homosexual, deeply closeted. He died of AIDS,
yeah.
And his boyfriend also was dying of AIDS. And Cohn called up Trump and he said, "Will you get a hotel room for my boyfriend who's dying of AIDS?" And Trump got him this crummy hotel room. And then he sent the bill to Roy Cohn. Cohn refused to pay it, and he made a public statement saying, "Donald Trump p***s ice water." And if you think about that, that's exactly what this guy is. He's a man without empathy.
Right.
And Cohn called it.
Isn't that one of the characteristics of a sociopath?
Yeah, or a narcissist.
Lack of empathy.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. A cruelty, really,
right,
that Cohn displayed. I mean, after all, the Rosenbergs were parents of two little children, and he had them executed. And a cruelty that Trump displays. Look what he's doing to the immigrants who he's deporting, and the Muslims who he's banning.
And families and communities. Bear with us, we're in a studio with construction. Michael, we've talked on this show in the past about fascism, a term that is often loosely thrown around. But seriously, do you think that Trump has the qualities of a fascist?
Yes, I do. Although I don't think that we're experiencing fascism in America. I mean, we wouldn't be broadcasting this program.
Right.
We were. One of the characteristics of fascism is the main characteristic, really, is that it sets up a situation where there are no organizations that mediate between the state and the individual. You can't have a political party. You can't have free speech. And we're not there yet. In fact, we're somewhere very far away from that in one sense, because groups on the left are doing tremendous. The ACLU raised $23 million in one weekend.
Yes, Michael, I agree with you, but I'm also very concerned about the onslaught against the remaining independent media. Trump's exclusion of the New York Times and other groups from press conferences at different times, and really all-out attacks on the so-called Fourth Estate.
Yeah, of course. But we have the internet. We've got our own independent newspapers. There's nothing that says we're going to win this. You know, I have to educate, agitate, organize. People are doing that to an unprecedented. I mean, this hasn't happened since the 1930s. And there's a polarization going on, and there's activity on both sides. The bad guys aren't going to lay down. We see what they're doing. I mean, I made a list of some of the laws that they've proposed.
Well, they want to do away with the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, essentially.
It's suicidal for humanity that they would want more drilling, more coal, dumping tops of mountains into streams. Mm. That they would do that, it's hard to even fathom.
Yeah.
Public schools, Gloria Steinem said when they picked cabinet positions, they found a fox for every hen house.
Right.
And they found Betsy DeVos, who's
the charter school champion, right,
from Michigan. They want to get rid of public schools. Public schools was the great accomplishment of the American democracy. And they want to get rid of them, and instead they want to give people vouchers so they can go to parochial schools, they can go to schools that are run by capitalist corporations, so they can turn education into a profit. And what they'll do is, rather than teach children to be creative, independent thinkers, they'll teach them to fill a slot in the technocratic apparatus. That's what they want.
And, Michael, what about private prisons? We know how ineffective those are. They want to privatize more.
They want to privatize more. And they want to privatize, they already have to a large extent, services in the prisons.
Right, like health care.
Like health care, like food. And how about the right to work laws? They want to get rid of unions in all 50 states. They want to punish sanctuary cities. They want to get rid of the National Endowment for the Arts.
And public radio, no doubt.
And public, yeah. Sure. And if they get rid of that, that puts more pressure on other organizations that give out art grants. They want to get rid of that. And even the pettiest things, they want to allow shooting of rare wildlife.
Mm. Yeah.
So what we're up against is truly a cruel and fascist program. Will they succeed? We don't know. We're fighting back. That's why I think it's useful to think about Trump with respect to his mentor, Roy Cohn. Nicholas von Hoffman wrote a great biography of Roy Cohn. I went back and read it once Trump was elected. We'll post the Sidney Blumenthal article on our website on Cohn. And this won't be the last discussion, I'm sure, that we'll have about this monster.
Michael, in 2006, you and I took part in a panel at the Brecht Forum called If It's Not Fascism, What Is It? And that was with Mark Crispin Miller.
And Bertel Ullman.
Right.
Professors at NYU.
Correct. We might want to play a few excerpts from that since it's...
it was 10 years ago, and I thought it was farsighted. Let's do it.
Let's take a listen.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a speech delivered by Professor Bertel Ullman on the same evening at the Brecht Forum. The title of the forum is, If It's Not Fascism, What Is It? Bertel Ullman is a professor of politics at the New York University and has written and edited over a dozen books, including Alienation, Marx's Conception of Man in Capitalist Society, Social and Sexual Revolution.
If it's not fascism, then what is it? Well, what is the importance in the label that we give it? In my view, it has a great deal of importance. For there are consequences which affect our propaganda, which affect the kind of analysis that we can make of the existing situation, and finally, which have serious implications for the kind of political strategy that we can and want to use. But before answering this important question, what label to give what is going on in America today, There are a couple of distinctions that need to be made. Every fascist is an authoritarian, but not every authoritarian is a fascist. Every fascist state does away with civil liberties and punishes dissent with imprisonment and sometimes with death. But not every state which acts in this way, a fascist state. Every fascist state is totalitarian, but not every totalitarian state is fascist. Stalinist Russia, Stalinist Soviet Union, for example. And finally, and most important, every fascist state is a dictatorship, but not every dictatorship is a fascist dictatorship. Indeed, most of the dictatorships of the last 100 years have not been fascist, have been run by military figures, often with the help of a junta of generals, whereas the two main fascist states that existed in the 20th century, Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, the dictators there were not military men, and they had to do certain things, take certain positions in order to win the support of the generals in those countries. This very, very important difference, which I'll try to elaborate on a little later. In short, I'm trying to suggest that there's some value, but also a great danger in trying to establish the character of the United States today and decide what kind of label to use in referring to it, by relying too much on making comparisons between what existed in Nazi Germany and Mussolini Italy and what exists today. One more distinction before I go into what I think fascism is. There is an important difference in thinking about fascism depending on whether we're talking about fascism in power or fascism on the road to power, that the conditions which are crucial for the rise of fascism bring out different features than the characteristics of fascist states once, fascist parties once in power. We'll begin then with the main characteristics of fascism in power. And use the two countries, Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy, as our models. These are, of course, the countries which most people admit as being classic examples of fascism. The main characteristics of fascism in power are, first, the absolute rule of one man through an authoritarian party over everyone and everything else. Two, fascism has the support not only of the middle class, particularly the lower middle class and the farmers, what in Europe is called the peasants, but also, at least certainly very soon after they come to power, also of the large majority of the rest of the population. Three, there are no other power centers in a fascist society other than the fascist party. No other economic, political, social, cultural, or even religious power centers which detract from the authority and the point of view of the ruling fascist party. Four, while the capitalist class don't control the fascist leader, as is sometimes suggested, I think, in bad Marxist works, of which there are a few, this is the class that benefits most from fascist rule in the security which fascism gives to the economic rule of the capitalist class and the unequal distribution. The rapid expansion of the arms industry and other preparations for war, which go on almost immediately when the fascists take power in a country, through the destruction, certainly terribly important, of independent trade unions and other organizations of the working class, And finally, through an imperialist foreign policy and wars that greatly expand the capitalist opportunities for business and profit.
We speak today with John Pilger, who is one of the world's renowned investigative journalists and documentary filmmakers. He's known for his conscience and bravery and acute historical insight. We talked to him about his recent article in Counterpunch magazine titled, "Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue." Using the word carefully, Pilger describes a new kind of fascism centered in America, but based on the big lie and a wars of aggression. We get a historical perspective from Pilger going all the way back to the end of the Second World War. If you think the wars in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now the Ukraine happened by happenstance, you are mistaken, says Pilger. These are part of an American effort to become the global power. John Pilger has worked in many facets of journalism, including as a correspondent in the Vietnam War, the Middle East desk for Reuters in London, and a producer for the Independent Television Network in London. His articles appear worldwide in newspapers such as The Guardian, The Independent, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times.
John Pilger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
John, we were intrigued and excited both to talk to you about a new article that you wrote that appeared in Counterpunch called "Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue." And yeah. It was an extraordinary article, really summing up, I think you would say, since 1945, what the United States in particular has been doing around the world. And if you could begin by maybe giving us your overall thesis of that article and why you're talking about it as a form of fascism.
Well, I think it's about definitions, and it's about the way we look back on fascism and its Nazi iconography. I mean, I've always been very cautious about using the term fascism because it is so associated with Nazism, but it does apply to the rampant role of United States administrations and their allies since 1945. I mean, actual fascism that is very much like Nazi fascism was set up throughout Latin America, first in Brazil, then on to Chile and Argentina, and right through that suffering continent, Nazi fascism was created by the United States, and of course throughout Central America as well. But a more, let's say, subtle kind of fascism is an insidious kind of fascism, now runs right through U.S. policy, especially as its dominance is challenged. It was always there, but now that its dominance is challenged by two powers, not as great as the United States, but one certainly in economic terms rapidly becoming great, and that's China, challenged to some degree by Russia, but challenged most of all by the fact that we're in a period where the old imperial neo-colonial period is being seriously challenged by a post-colonial period. I mean, that's exactly what this new invasion of Yemen is about. If you look at all the countries that are lining up with their U.S. weapons and U.S. logistics and U.S. backing to attack this impoverished, divided country, they are all colonial creations either of the earlier powers like Britain and France or of the United States. Saudi Arabia is the absolute epitome of this. So that, as I see it, is what the present state of the world is. It is we're moving into a struggle between basic, almost 19th century imperialism and its hangover, and something of a new order. that new order, we don't know exactly what it is, but it's represented by new economic powers such as China, undoubtedly a resurgent Russia. I mean, the fear of Iran is really that Iran is at the center of this new order. Not that it's backing countries like Yemen, which it isn't, but that it has refused to surrender its independence. So it is colonial societies, colonial-backed countries versus these new orders that has produced this almost ferocity that is now becoming a kind of fascism everywhere. The overthrow of the government in Kiev in Ukraine, although turned upside down by Western propaganda, was part of that. The fact that Obama has lied that he's leaving Afghanistan when in fact he's staying in Afghanistan. And as I say, this new war in Yemen. War and aggression is the essence of fascism. The Nazis certainly demonstrated that to us. And the disregard, of course, for human life, that is very much a feature of U.S. policy throughout the world.
And you might want to add the big lie to that as well.
The big lie accompanies everything. It's the big lie and an insidious propaganda that inverts reality, inverts the truth. You know, most, for me now, and I've been a journalist for quite a few years, most television news, most news, in fact, is unwatchable because I then have to sit in front of it and deconstruct it or monitor it at the very least, that there is no option of gaining any information from it or knowledge from it. So the big lie has insinuated itself right throughout the media. The big lie has worked in Afghanistan. The big lie worked now famously in Iraq. And we now know that probably about the same number of people died in Iraq as a result of that big lie, as died in Rwanda. So fascism's lies and its aggression and its manipulations throughout the world, and manipulations, at one point something like a third of the members of the United Nations, 69 nations, had been attacked by the United States. Sanctions, so-called sanctions, that rather benign word, has been imposed on more than a third of the world's populations in some form. So the lie plus violence plus threat plus manipulation adds up to a very modern, let's say, post-Nazi form of fascism, and I think it is absolutely appropriate now to use the word, if only to concentrate people now, those who understand and are worried by much of this, to concentrate their minds on what is happening in their world and to shake people away from the idea that fraudulent liberal leaders like Obama, who is one of the great liars and one of the real men of violence on the world stage, can solve this, can make this better. We're at a stage, I think, of critical self-awareness. Either we understand these movements, we may not be able to analyze it exactly and understand where it's going, but we understand these movements in the world, or we don't.
I'm tempted to ask you what the big lie was in a number of instances, Serbia, Libya, Iraq, Ukraine, Afghanistan, because they were all pulled off under the curtain of a big lie. And the other thing that I'd like to hear from you is what the real interests are that underlie the reason for the big lie. I don't know where to start because they've lied all over the world. You pick a place.
Well, you're right. It's a landscape. I think in a way, it is making the connections, isn't it? And I suppose that's what I've tried to do in that article and other pieces, is to make the connections, which are glaringly obvious. I mean, you mentioned Libya. Okay. Now, in 2011, NATO, which is the basically the U.S. Enforcer, it has no legal basis whatsoever to roam around the world attacking countries, and it does it illegally, actually. It launched something, almost 10,000 so-called strike sorties against Libya, and even on its own statistics, a third of these were against civilian targets. It flattened two cities, Misurata and Sirte. They were carpet bombed. I mean, the attack on Libya was absolutely ferocious. Now, the big lie was expressed by Obama when he said that we knew that if we waited one more day, that Benghazi, a city the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. Well, that was nonsense. There was no massacre in Benghazi, and the whole notion of the massacre was based on the fabrication of a group of Islamist militias who were just raring to, had been Gaddafi's opponents for years, were raring for the opportunity, were handed it, and gave it to the news media, specifically Reuters. It can go back to Reuters, that they said there was going to be a bloodbath, a massacre like we saw in Rwanda. That was enough. And the so-called humanitarian intervention then against Gaddafi was failed. Now, that was a big lie. I mean, Gaddafi, in fact, had had been going along with the boys in Washington and London and Paris and wanting really to get back into the game. But Gaddafi was always considered under grave suspicion because of his support for the real possibility of economic independence in Africa. He was prepared to use his massive oil wealth to underwrite with gold an African development bank, an African currency. Now, this was all very audacious and may never have happened. But certainly Obama apparently believed it because he went ahead and confiscated $30 billion from Libya's central bank, and that's what Gaddafi had earmarked to use in Africa. Now, if you look at Africa today, following that attack on Libya in 2011, the U.S., the gates of Africa virtually opened for the U.S. It was already there. AFRICOM, the U.S. command, had finally got into Addis Ababa, and right throughout Africa, we've seen these this mass bribing with money and weapons of regimes throughout Africa. There is a U.S. military presence in the overwhelming majority of African countries now. For the U.S., if you look at why they're there, well, they think that their new enemy is China, and perhaps it is in terms of economic development. China has done a lot of very useful deals with many African countries. It has built a lot of infrastructure. It has taken resources. It has bought up land. But in return, it has built roads and bridges and so on. The point is, it hasn't fired a shot and hasn't sent a single soldier into Africa. But they are the perceived new enemy. As we move on through that, the new big lie, which was uttered here in Australia by a U.S. admiral who appeared yesterday. They often come here because they get such a They get such a warm welcome.
Yeah, you can keep
and
them.
He said that there was a new wall of China being built across the seas of Asia. So here we have a version, if you like, of Colin Powell's famous, infamous presentation to the United Nations Security Council, or Reagan's on the threat in Nicaragua and Central America about a Soviet presence in Central America. Here's the latest version called A New Wall of China Being Built. These connections are terribly important, and I say they're obvious, but we really need to make them and to understand them. Otherwise, we'll lose complete control of much of our world, many of our governments already. So that's certainly how I see it.
John, I really appreciate it, and I was really interested when you mentioned Libya and you talked about an African bank and Gaddafi's ideas of going off really the U.S. dollar. And I recall that wasn't Saddam Hussein considering also not going off the U.S. dollar for selling oil?
Yes, that was a factor. I'm not sure it was the factor, but certainly that's a common story with so-called dissident oil-producing countries such as Venezuela and Libya and Iran and, as you point out, Iraq, that they threaten the dominance of the petrodollar. And I think that's part of it. Certainly, there's no question that the Middle East would not be in the state it's in. Well, there are two reasons. Israel-Palestine is clearly at the center of it. But oil is and fossil fuels are absolutely critical to understanding this part of the world. There just wouldn't be the rapacious interest. So that then makes sense. But, and as you point out, when Saddam Hussein threatened to do this, that was almost the last straw. And he went to a particular OPEC meeting where he, I think, announced this, that he was going to give up the petrodollar, give up U.S. dollars. That takes away a prop of U.S. power throughout the world. It's only one of them, but it's an important one.
Let's switch our attention to the Ukraine, because I think there is a fine example of American aggression and American lies. What do you think is the ultimate purpose of America's meddling in the Ukraine and having their government overthrown?
The ultimate purpose is to subvert and dismember Russia. Ukraine is an important borderland. Ukraine means borderland. It's like a highway to Russia. The Nazis found that. They swept across it to the Soviet cities. Ukraine, of course, was then part of the Soviet Union. There seems no doubt about this, that the ultimate aim is that the disorder and division in Ukraine will spill over into Russia and provoke those elements in Russia that want to bring down the present Russian government. The baseline for this is independence. It's whether or not you like the government is beside the point. Russia is a big independent country, as Iran is an independent country, as Venezuela is an independent country. Independence is intolerable. And on the scale of Russia's independence, it's very intolerable because it stands at the gates to Eurasia. And at the other end of Eurasia, of course, is China. And Russia is seen as an obstacle to continuing, enduring U.S. dominance. It's not just dominance, it's seen as another voice. Again, that almost a post-colonial voice in the way that China is, in the way that even Syria is. Now, as I say, you don't have to approve of these governments, but that's the way they are perceived. In other words, overthrowing the Russian administration is, I believe, the reason for this absolutely disastrous U.S.-engineered coup d'etat in Ukraine, but above all, the encircling of Russia by a missile system, the biggest military build-up, which is the U.S. build-up, in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Republic since the Second World War. Imagine, just for a second, all this happening on the Canadian border or the Mexican border. That's what it is. And this open threat and provocation and isolation of Russia, that has been succeeded to some degree. But because the Western media doesn't really report the news, its failure hasn't been reported. And that is the coming together of Russia and China, the strengthening of relations between those two powers that are now presenting a new power bloc, the very nightmare that the United States has had all these years. So that is the cause. I mean, the failure, again, has been turned into propaganda. There's no question that it was NATO's and the U.S.'s ambition to seize Crimea, and there'd be a NATO base there had they succeeded in doing so, and they weren't successful. This is playing with fire, playing with nuclear fire now. I mean, if you read carefully what Putin has said and what his people have said, their whole narrative has shifted now towards the acceptance that they might have to defend themselves. And that could easily come down to nuclear war. That's why the recklessness of this Obama adventure, this latest Obama adventure in Ukraine, is almost breathtaking.
Let me ask you something that struck me in your writing in your recent article. I always thought about Jimmy Carter. You know, he came in after the Vietnam War is over, so his hands were tied a little bit. And I always sort of liked him because he was a combination of weak and human rightsy, and there were no real wars that I saw under those 4 years that he was in office. And then you start talking a bit about Brzezinski and what his role was under Carter, and of course what it has been going forward. So I'd like to hear you talk about that a bit.
Well, I remember I reported Carter. I reported quite a few U.S. election campaigns, and I think Carter was, Carter's 76 win was one of them. I remember the, here we go again, all the hopes, and yes, he seemed to be, and is undoubtedly a decent and reasonable human being. But on Carter's watch, when he was president, let me deal with first Kissinger, who was hung over into that administration.
He's still around. He's advising Scott Walker.
Yeah, I know. Well, I saw a wonderful bit of YouTube the other day where some very courageous young man tried to arrest him. And I was cheering, but unfortunately he wasn't taken into custody, so he's still at large. But he sent illegally weapons to East Timor.
That's right.
The Carter administration. East Timor was invaded with Kissinger's nod to Suharto and Gerald Ford's nod to Suharto when they visited Jakarta in 1975. In 1976, when Carter came to power, the arms flowed. And it was a former, rather brave CIA officer who appeared in one of my films, Lichty, William Lichty, who was the CIA man on the desk in Jakarta and saw these arms flow in and what they were doing to the people of East Timor, where Suharto massacred a third of the population. So that happened under Carter's watch. But perhaps the most significant was the appointment of Brzezinski as national security advisor to Carter. So he, who had this apparently very liberal president and this very illiberal national security advisor, who in 1979, the last year of Carter's administration, persuaded Carter to authorize secret arms to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And through the 80s, this grew into $500 million worth of arms. And of course, the Mujahideen lit really the whole fire of so-called jihadism in that part of the world. So that began under Carter. And it began with Brzezinski, who, of course, is like Kissinger. The two of them have been gurus to various administrations since then. And Brzezinski's the grand chessboard. His book is regarded by a lot of these think tanks as the manual for how you dominate the world. I'm afraid that, you know, one of the last obstacles is to knock over the good old liberal delusions about these people. Obama's ascendancy succeeded in virtually getting rid of the anti-war movement in the United States, because everyone fell on their knees and said that God has arrived, finally, the liberal God. And that was total nonsense as well. So I think a lot of people understand that now, but it's important that it doesn't now run on to the next one. I mean, Hillary Clinton apparently is the choice of many women because she's a woman. And this is and during her last campaign to be the candidate, she promised, and I think I quoted, to eliminate Iran. So good luck with her. But,
and had a great vote on the Iraq war as well, John.
Yes. Yeah. The big issue now is whether she used her Gmail account or something or other.
We're speaking with John Pilger on his new article in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. And John, I wanted to ask you, Michael's got a last question, but I wanted to ask you about the ideology that underpins all this aggression, and that's the American exceptionalism. And you quote Obama saying, I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being. Talk to us about that.
Yes, it's almost skin-crawling to hear it, isn't it? Because, you know, my knowledge of it, I think probably my political education really began in the United States when I lived there and worked there. Exceptionalism itself is, exceptionalism in Britain and Germany and all the countries that think that are taken over by certain ideologies regard themselves greatest human beings born. But American exceptionalism is one that is not recognized as such. And I've always felt that Americanism was the most unrecognized ideology. And it is the most powerful ideology in the world, and it is the predatory ideology. But it's not recognized. And even across the American Academy, you can see people, and I won't name them, fighting not to recognize Americanism for what it is. I think I started when if you begin to analyze this, you used to be called, not so much these days, anti-American, which is a very odd term. I mean, how can you be anti-American? It's ridiculous. But what they were saying was that you were anti-Americanism, and that's true. This is a predatory ideology. It is fueled by the fact that America is, on paper at least, a great democracy, and this kind of the brainwashing that supports it is itself unrecognized. That's very interesting, because it runs right throughout the media, right throughout the academy. with massive exceptions all over the place. That's why some of the greatest thinkers and opponents to it are in the United States. But it's whereas we look on other ideologies, they become headlines, you know, be it communism or fascism or Islamist extremism and all the other isms that are used. This ism is the most interesting because it is the biggest, the most aggressive, and the most unrecognized.
And the most well-armed.
And the most well-armed. Well, you know, this current expression of Americanism as it pours arms and planes into the heroic Saudi Air Force as it attacks villages in Yemen, I read recently that that in spite of a global ban, the U.S. companies had supplied Saudi Arabia with $640 million worth of cluster bombs. Many of those would be dropped on Yemen. It is over the last, I'm not sure what period, but something like $60 billion since the congressional ban on selling arms to Saudi was lifted, $60 billion in all kinds of horrific hardware has been sent to Saudi Arabia. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a critical component to it. The U.S. may have outsourced the manufacturing of its once great manufacturing industries to Asia, and especially, ironically, China, but its arms industry remains absolutely intact, powerful, all-powerful, and all-profitable. And whenever some terrible event such as this killing of civilian people, and especially children in Yemen, comes up, it's a U.S. attack. Every time the Israelis attack, it's a U.S. attack. They're flying U.S. planes. You know, but it's not said that way. But these arms, without these arms, of course, there wouldn't be attacks. That's a very important part of it.
John, I want to conclude with a last question to you. And just before I do, I just want to recommend highly to people your website, johnpilger.com. It's remarkable. Of course, you can see not all 58 of your films on there, but I think you stream a number of them, as I recall, as well as a lot of your articles, books, etc. Highly recommended. And my last question, you end your article with what our responsibilities are and what we have to do as people who care about the issues you're talking about, and how we can at least try going forward to do better. And why don't you talk about how you're admonishing people at the end of the piece?
Yeah. Well, I think it comes down to ourselves. You know, you often get in audiences and talking about this, people saying, well, what can I do? Which is an extraordinary question, actually, in societies where there is a great deal of free information, like the United States and other Western countries. So people don't really have the excuse of not knowing, but you have to find out, and I think it's that's the first responsibility, is finding out. The second responsibility is, and then identifying and calling lies of governments, the lies of presidents, understanding the propaganda, deconstructing it. And understanding it to themselves, the recklessness of warmongers, and not, if you like, intellectually colluding with them, or morally colluding with them. That goes on all the time. Good people do that. They collude with them. Oh, but it can't be that bad, that kind of thing. Because what is going on, really, with this propaganda and with this bloodletting throughout the world done in our name, is that it represents a conquest of us. And if we allow that conquest, and it's a conquest of our minds and humanity, self-respect, our sense of ourselves, if we allow that conquest, in other words, and this goes back to so many great and awful events in the recent past, that if we remain silent, then the conquest succeeds. Now, it's people, understanding that if they're prepared to be actually taken over by this power, controlled by it and by its propaganda, then that conquest succeeds. That should be unacceptable.
With those wise words, we conclude the program, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we hope that you'll join us again.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.